Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, welcome to the Snooker Scene podcast. I'm Dave Hendon. If there's one rule of podcasting, it's never release an episode on a Saturday. Saturday's not a podcast day. Don't record one. Don't release one on a Saturday. Well, here we are. It's Saturday. And I promised a second live episode from York. People have been saying, well, come on, where is it? Well, here it is. I'm not commentating this afternoon. It's been a very busy week. A lot of long matches. Great matches. Everyone's ill at the tournament. That's the other thing. All the pundits, everyone, the TV crews, production teams, staff at the tournament, everyone's ill. The winter sort of virus bug, whatever it is, has gone round. And so that's what's happening. But the tournament is brilliant. And we had great excitement just last night. The biggest ever points tally in a frame between Mark Williams and Ding Junhui. A lot of close finishes. And as I record this, we have semi-finals comprising Ronnie O'Sullivan against Hossein Bafai and Judd Trump against Ding Junhui. Now, by the time you listen to this, the first one will be over. And we'll be looking forward to the final. But anyway, I said I'd be back, and I am. And that's about as much as I can say about why this episode exists. It won't be a long one, but we've got some emails to catch up on that we haven't dealt with already. So let's dive in. Now, of course, there was some sent after the Champion of Champions, which seems a long time ago now. In reality, it's a couple of weeks, but a lot's happened since then. Of course, Mark Allen had a stunning win over Judd Trump, 10-3. Kelly Barker writes, he says, I just thought I'd email in to say what an enjoyable week as always Champions was. Mark Allen was back near his best form and thoroughly deserved the title. Not many players will beat Judd like that this season. Judd looked especially good leading up to the final, though, and some of his hot shots will be remembered for many a year. It all bodes well for a cracking UK championship ahead. I wouldn't bet against either Judd or Mark lifting the title in York. Which is a bit unfair to read that bit out, because Kelly, she sent this obviously after the final. This is a couple of weeks ago. Judd is still going, though, so, you know, half right. She says, a word to you on the previous week and a tremendous international championship in China. Getting these events back on the calendar has been the most pleasing thing for me this season, and credit to Zhang Ander for the way he won it. It's always good to see a new winner, and who's to say what he'd go on to do now? When, of course, he was quarterfinals in York this week as well. She says, finally, thanks, Dave, and all the ITV team for making those events different class these days. I feel lucky to be a snooker fan at a time where there's so much to watch, morning, noon and night, on one channel or another. Well, thank you, Kelly. Yeah, it's, we are kind of spoiled at the moment, and hopefully, I'm sure you are enjoying the UK Championship. It kind of goes without saying, really, but thank you for that. And the Champion of Champions as well from Callum Law. Now, of course, I knew that when I asked for the UK Championship memories, I'd missed a few out, and Callum actually, in this email, has got some, so we'll come to that shortly, but I'll just, on what he says after the Champion of Champions, he said, it's been a funny season for me. I managed to watch nearly as much snooker as I would normally due to work and personal commitments. However, I saw plenty of the Champion of Champions and thoroughly enjoyed it. From the outset to conclusion, I thought Mark Allen was excellent. I'm not sure if I'm alone in thinking this, but is Mark slightly underrated in some quarters? He's been a top 16 player for many years now, scores very heavily. The only trophy he's really missing from his CV is the World Championship. Well, I suppose just on that, Callum, I suppose that's the thing, really. If he won the World Championship, it would be, you couldn't really, you know, say anything about him. I'm not sure he is underrated. I suppose he's one of those players, though, when the tournament starts, he's not necessarily, you know, in the first few in the betting, but he's kind of always there as a threat, and obviously in the last year or so, he's been very much a threat. Callum says, the biggest compliment I think I could pay Mark is that at his best, I'd say he's capable of winning any tournament, beating anyone that's ever picked up a cue. Now then, Callum also says, you asked for UK Championship memories, I've picked out a few from when I first started watching snooker. So 2008 final, Sean Murphy, Marco Fu. Being 10 years old at the time, and with the final session starting at 8 p.m, on Sunday, a school night, I only got to watch an hour or so of the last session live, but my dad taped the rest for me, and I watched the drama unfold over the next two nights after avoiding the result. Well, those were the days, weren't they? You could have avoided the result, I suppose, just about pre-social media. You could avoid the result for 2 days. It's pretty incredible. 2009 semi-final, John Higgins, Ronnie O'Sullivan. John looked to be cantering to victory at 8-2 up. Ronnie produced an amazing comeback to 8-all before a granite final frame from John to win it. Was absolutely transfixed watching it and remains one of the best matches I've seen. And finally, 2010 final, John Higgins, Mark Williams, just epic stuff, and in some ways perhaps John's best tournament win, coming back from 9-5 down to win and also following on from everything earlier that year. Another final where I take the conclusion and watched it the next day. So again, it seems in those days you could do that. He says, I'm really looking forward to the UK Championship. Every snooker fan has great memories of it. And he says, did you see the stuff on social media about Ray Reardon making a century last week? What a player, what a snooker man. Well, yes, indeed, he made one at the age of 91 on what we were told was a tough table. So that gives hope to everybody. Now, Adrian writes, he says, first of all, I wanted to say I discovered your podcast during lockdown and went back and listened to every one. So thank you for taking the time to give your insight and opinions on the game for the avid snooker fan. Well, thank you, Adrian. If you've listened to every one, then you deserve some sort of MBE or something. But that's very good of you. He says, I've never emailed before, but the question last week about favourite bits of commentary, I had to give mine. During the 2012 World Championship, when Stephen Hendry made the 147 against Stuart Bingham, John Virgo, with that perfect cadence and excitement, says, well done, Stephen, you've done the game proud. It was just a magical moment with the former great champion doing what he does best, and for me it was one of the last great moments in snooker. I watched that break all the time, and for me it's just as good as Ronnie's fastest 147 15 years previously. And on the same subject, commentary lines, Phil Spivey, he says, the subject of memorable commentary lines is brought up. One of my favourites is Ted Lowe in 1985 after Dennis Taylor potted the last pink and he's walking around the table, simply says, the final frame, the final black. Yeah, it's a terrific line, I agree. He then says, you already mentioned his no after Davis missed the thin black, but that is also a classic. Has more ever been said with just one word? Well, it's a good point. I mean, I think I can't conceive of that being done today. You know, the tendency to elaborate, I suppose, would be too tempting. But Ted was a less is more kind of chap. And that no, I mean, like you say, there's more meaning in that no than, you know, probably anything that's ever been said on commentary. Because everyone knew the exact sort of feeling he had, the concern, the surprise, you know, the disbelief. It's all there in that one word, just two letters. You never said more, you're quite right. Now, we always like to hear from people who've been to events, and Dan has been to the UK qualifiers at the Morningside Arena in Leicester. So let's hear from Dan. He says, great podcast and commentary, keep it up. I know you said you don't get many emails, but lots of us snooker fans love the podcast. Well, it's not quite true, Dan. I get a few, you know, and we try to read them all out. But anyway, he says, I recently decided to spend a day at the UK qualifiers at the Morningside Arena in Leicester. Advanced trains and a day ticket for just under £20. Great value. I was expecting one of the leisure centre style venues, but was pleasantly surprised. It took ages to find the entrance due to lack of directions and a sign the size of a postage stamp, but we can gloss over that. You're right about that, actually, Dan. It's not the easiest to find. It's called Memory Lane. I mean, you literally take a trip down Memory Lane to get there. It could be better signposted, I agree. Anyway, he says, there was no basketball going on in the background or general sports centre noise. The toilet facilities were good. The stands were decent, comfortable seating and close to the tables. 6 tiers for the main tables and 3 tiers for the back tables. On this note, I think World Snooker must now use their own seating. The World Qualifiers used to have terrible regular chairs on wooden gym block seating for the back tables. Last year, they changed to less tables and 2 proper stands. I took my own refreshments and a good job, as these were very much tuck shop style, and I'm not paying £2.50 for the delights of a machine coffee. Anyway, I sat on the back row of the second set of tables for the afternoon session and saw 2 deciders and a close 6-4 on the tables in my view. Moving to the Judgment Day style system for the UKs has really worked well and restored some of the prestige. The games should all be 2 session again, in my opinion, but I guess you can't have everything. I recommend going to these qualifiers as you get great value action. I openly criticise some of the things World Snooker do, and they clearly take a budget approach to qualifiers, but I felt they were very well done in this case. When the main stages come round, you get all the quality TV coverage and camera angles and can always stay at home. Well, thank you, Dan, and I'm glad you enjoyed the trip there. Yes, I mean, I think we've sort of heard in the past that not all qualifiers are accessible to the public, but quite often when they are, not many people go. I mean, there weren't that many people there. There were some hardy souls who made the trip. But they don't seem to be a massive draw, which is a shame, actually, because you get to see a lot of different players. You know, 8 tables there, 4 on the last 2 days. And, you know, you get to sort of be part of the action before it kind of cranks up in York. You get to see how the players got through. So qualifiers are always kind of interesting to go to. And they are cheap, as you said. You know, there are costs involved in obviously allowing the public in. But I'm glad you enjoyed your trip. Now, Gavin Power has written a very interesting email here, which I'm going to read out. He says, I've been a snooker fan since the age of 7, beginning with Dennis Taylor's World Championship triumph, fully indulging in the sport and its epic Hendry v. White rivalry unfolding throughout the 1990s, and now visiting live matches when time permits. My first live snooker was at Goff's, so it was nice to learn a little bit more from your podcast as to the drawbacks of the venue for snooker, including ceiling heights and the resulting impact, the appearance of a long table on television screens. There's been much talk recently about who the greatest ever player is, Hendry or O'Sullivan, with perhaps Davis or John Higgins appearing in third place. It got me thinking about how you truly measure greatness. I think the fairest measurement may be a ranking of snooker players throughout the history of the game based upon some essential criteria. Okay, so this is Gavin's criteria. Number one, evaluating them against each other when their form sees them play at their peak, imagining them battling in a best of 19. Best of 19 seems to be a fair duration of frames to enable the better player to emerge victorious. It's certainly the minimum starting point. Others may argue best of 25, 31, 33 or 35 will be fairer. But once that is agreed, then the subjective assessment can begin. Okay, so we've got the groundwork laid out. He says, number two, the ranking assumes matches are played under a real pressure scenario. This ensures players are evaluated based not only upon their talent, but also their temperament under pressure. So my top 32 of all time looks like this. I'm going to read it out here. He says, I would love to know your thoughts. Before I begin, players that helped shape the game in previous generations have not always made the cut, because I feel the standard of play in the last few decades has increased relatively significantly. Now, this is Gavin's order, okay? I have nothing to do with anyone else. Gavin has come up with this. He has looked at the matches in terms of as he says, the meaningfulness of them, the pressure they're under, and he's looked at length of matches, and he's come up with this, and this is his list, and I'm going to read it out from, we've got plenty of time this week, so from 32 down, these are the best 32 players ever, starting at 32. This is like Alan Fluff Freeman on Top of the Pops. there's one for the teenagers. Okay, so number 32, Karen Wilson. Number 31, Mark Allen. Number 30, Alan McManus. 29, Terry Griffiths. 28, Barry Hawkins. 27, Doug Mountjoy. 26, Graham Dott. 25, Matthew Stevens. 24, Stuart Bingham. 23, Luca Brasell. 22, Cliff Thorburn. 21, Peter Ebdon. 20, Dennis Taylor. 19, John Spencer. 18, Ken Doherty. 17, Paul Hunter. 16, Joe Johnson. 15, Alex Higgins. 14, Neil Folds. 13, Ray Reardon. 12, Neil Robertson. 11, Sean Murphy. And now we move into the top 10. This is Gavin Power's list, which he's worked out through his own criteria, which he's explained already. So this is the top 10 in reverse order, okay? Let's see if your favourites are in here. Number 10, John Parrott. Number 9, Ding Junhui. Number 8, Mark Williams. Number 7, Jimmy White. Number 6, Steve Davis. Into the top 5, number 5, Judd Trump. Number 4, Mark Selby. So now we have the top 3. Okay, I think we know who they are, but it's like the Christmas number one, this, isn't it? Waiting for the Christmas number one, as we used to do when records meant anything. Who is going to be in the top 3 in which order? Well, here's the answer. Number 3, John Higgins. Number 2, if I could afford a drum roll, I'd give you one. Number 2, according to Gavin, is Ronnie O'Sullivan. And number 1 is Stephen Hendry. Now, there'll be people that are out there who've made it this far in the podcast saying, don't be so ridiculous. But that's what he's come up with based on his own criteria. And it may seem pointless to you, but he's done it. And good luck to him. I mean, there's some interesting ones there. I mean, Neil Folds would be happy with 14th, I think. Neil Robertson out of the top 10, maybe controversial. John Parrott is an interesting one there. He was a far better player than I think people remember. I mean, he won the World Championship in the midst of Hendry, Davis, White, you know, that era. And won a lot of sort of non-British ranking events, UK champion as well, of course. But anyway, that's Gavin's list. And if anyone else wants to come up, I'm all for people coming up with their own, I don't like to say bogus criteria, but their own criteria for ranking players. Please do, whatever you want to come up with. It doesn't have to be a top 32, maybe a top 10, be more manageable. But whatever criteria you have for ranking the greatest players, maybe you just like the cut of their hair or, you know, or their accent. Whatever it is, we'll take anything. That's the motto of this podcast. We'll take anything. Brian Murray writes from Dublin. He says, I wanted to thank you for the podcast. Really entertaining. Thank you, Brian. I just wanted to ask you if you'd heard this question. How is it possible to get a break of eight and in that break pop four yellows? Well, Brian kindly answers it. He says, you and I are playing a frame. With one red left and you foul. I approach the table, I'm snookered on the last red and have a free ball. I take the yellow as my free ball. That's one yellow and 1 point. The yellow gets respotted, I then pop the yellow as my colour. Two yellows and 3 points. I then pop the last red. 4 points now. I then pop the yellow as my colour, so that's three yellows and 6 points. And then I start the colours in sequence, I pop the yellow. That's four yellows and 8 points. I then miss the green and leave the table. Sorry for the pointless trivia. Well, there we are. If that comes up in, you know, not going to come in with Mastermind or one of those programs, but if it comes up in a quiz, people know the answer now. He says, I recently was watching Barry Hawkins against Judd Trump. They're both left-handed. But I noticed when they use the rest, they both switch to their right hand. Why do you think they switch to their non-dominant hand for the rest shot, which is a harder shot? Do you know of any other players who do the same? I've never really understood that, to be honest. If anyone can shed any light on that, it's just something that they do. So I don't know is the answer. A lot of left-handed players these days, actually. But anyway, we'll move on. Sam Hoare writes, thank you for your magnificent podcast, which brings great cheer to so many of us. Well, wait till you listen to this episode, Sam. Anyway, he says, regarding the snooker triple wish list suggested by Mark and John, here are my three. So Mark and John, they came up with this last week, and Sam has answered the call. He says, number one, the leadership of World Snooker Tour becomes as hungry, ambitious and courageous as the leading professionals on the tour. Well, I'm sure it's not for me to answer for them, but I'm sure they would argue they already are. Sam, I mean, what I would say is, certainly the World Snooker staff, I mean, the hours this week have been absolutely brutal. They're long days, you know, they don't walk in at 5 to 1. A lot of late finishes, so people have been working hard, despite, as I say, the illness that's been sort of generally the bug that's been going around. Anyway, number two, it says, streaming, snooker is a perfect game for screens. Imagine 100 million people paying £10 a year to view snooker on their devices. That's a cool billion in revenue. Negotiate the broadcast rights so WST can stream events outside the broadcast territories of the BBC, Eurosport, ITV, etc. Well, I mean, again, just to answer that, I mean, in China, they do have an arrangement like that. They have streaming rights in China to all the events, and of course Matchroom Live, I mean, we've not heard necessarily totally complimentary things about that service, but it is generally available on there. There's a lot of different contracts, broadcast contracts, streaming contracts. Whether it could be as simple as just having one, like you say, and everyone pays to that one, I don't know. It may be a bit more complicated than that, but anyway, this is a wish list. And number three, snooker scene. The entire back catalogue is digitised and placed online by an enterprising budding journalist, and the podcast continues forever. Well, forever's a long time, of course. But anyway, thank you for that. And anyone else with a similar ideas, do let us know. Frankie writes, I was watching the Williams-Ding match. Now, this was last night, so he's hot off the press. So I was watching the Williams-Ding match, but unfortunately kept nodding off. But was woken by your excited dulcet tones in frame 8. There I was thinking there was a possible 147 on, but then I realised your enthusiastic chortles of commentary were about the possibility of a new record of the highest combined score in a frame, which duly occurred. I think Angles McManus was rather less impressed with that moment in snooker history. I wonder if that momentous record will ever be beaten. I'm grateful to your energetic excitement realising history was about to be made that I woke up to witness this great yet probable meaningless record. Well, thank you, Frankie. I mean, no, Alan was very engaged with it. Ding scored 94 points and lost the frame, which is extraordinary, really. Most ever scored in a frame that a player's lost. 196 points were scored. So that beat the old record, rather grisly frame between Dominic Dale and Peter Lyons in an old Wishy Classic qualifier. That was 192. So that was the record. That stood for 11 years. So, you know, it took a while to beat. I'm not sure Mark Williams necessarily wanted that record, but the fact is he's got it. And it was, I mean, obviously there were a lot of fouls, but the reason for that was a lot of good safety play. A lot of snookers, they're on the green about half an hour, which is one of those frames, 63 minutes. And this is the thing, it was very engaging and exciting, and people who, you know, have had all this nonsense about getting rid of snookers and all that, and, you know, there seem to be players out there who just want to make it easier for themselves, want to make the game easier. It's not supposed to be easy. If you want to make it easy, take 10 reds off the table, you know, or just have fewer colours and just less to do generally. It's supposed to be hard, it is hard, and if you're really good at it, the rewards are there. And that frame was very exciting, even though it was long and drawn out at times. It was high quality and ultimately historic, as you say. Joe Richards, I'm not sure if we can call this a thunderous polemic, but well, let's see what you think. So I just wanted to make a point regarding the seeding format for the UK and other tournaments being illogical. However, ironically, the quarterfinal lineups were excellent, so it has worked out quite well, with Selby, Trump and Williams Ding in one half and O'Sullivan in the other half. There's a potential for a good final if O'Sullivan can find some form and at least one blockbuster semi on the top of two blockbuster quarters. Having the world champion as number two seed for the UK is an odd one. Being number one in the world and being number three seed seems a strange one for me. I've always been against the defending champion being the number one seed also, as it often skews the draw if the defending champion is out of form. Ronnie and Trump should be seeded 1-2 based on the world rankings. Makes a lot more logical sense to me. Yes, Allen had a fantastic season early part of last year, and Brassell had a great world championship, but no way are they the two form players at the moment. Luckily, with them not getting knocked out, it hasn't skewed the balance of the draw too much, with Trump and O'Sullivan being seeded 3 and 4. But it still isn't going to help future draws pan out in the logical way. Of course, Allen was knocked out early on in round one. But anyway, he says you want the top four in the rankings, in theory, to have the ability to meet in the semis. I don't buy the argument you'll get a lot of repetition with the draws. Naturally, there's going to be other good players that beat the top four. But draws will become less skewed if they seed every ranking tournament based on world rankings. Obviously, the ITV series being based on the one-year ranking is effectively a similar process, so I get that will be different, which is fine, as the draws will then be based on the current in-form players. So draws naturally aren't skewed in that format. No other professional sport would have such a strange seeding format. Giving someone a number one seeding based on their performance 1 year ago is bizarre. Their form could have fallen off a cliff. Well, thank you, Joe. This is niche stuff, which, of course, is exactly what we want. There's two issues here, I suppose. One is, as you say, the defending champion being the number one seed, and the other is the world champion being seeded 2 automatically for every event. And in fact, for new events, I think the world champion would be seeded 1. But anyway, the reason, I mean, that's been there a long time. Now, I can't swear that it happened after Joe Johnson won in 86, but obviously, you know, the world champion used to basically be the world number one or very close to it. When you started to have the odd shot winner, of course, they wanted to make sure, being world champion is such a prestigious thing within the sport, you wanted to make sure that the world champion was at the tournaments and actually could, you know, play their full part by being seeded for events. It came into sharper focus, I guess, when Sean Murphy won. He didn't actually get in the top 16, but he was put in as the number two seed, which knocked Ian McCulloch out. He was actually world number 16, but he was knocked down to 17 because Murphy came in to that top 16 seeding bracket. And I think it is desirable to have the world champion, you know, making sure they are seeded at tournaments. Most of the time it would happen anyway, but every so often a shock winner comes through. It's a bit different now with 500,000 points. It's hard not to be in the top 16. But that's a long-standing convention that the world champion will be seeded second. Personally, I don't mind it because I think it does sort of illustrate the prestige of the world championship. In terms of seeding the defending champion as number one, I mean, that's a perk of winning it. I suppose it's become tradition now in a lot of tournaments that you will then start off the following year. It's not impossible, I suppose, to win a tournament and not be in the top 16 the following year. I mean, I think actually Gary Wilson is in that exact position this year at the Scottish Open. Now, should Gary Wilson, having won the tournament last year, have gone to qualify for the Scottish Open this year, maybe not even made it? I'm not so sure about that. I think actually it probably is right that he's seeded number one. There's so many tournaments now and so many sort of variations. It's not true to say that, I mean, the top 16, okay, the top four are seeded, but the rest of them are kind of jumbled up. So it's not like every event is going to be 1v16. That doesn't actually happen. So you do get a variance of draws. So you made your point very clearly. I have to say it doesn't bother me that much. But, you know, you've laid out the reasons you don't like it, and that's fair enough. Matt Owen, great work on Judgment Day recently. Yourself and Stephen Haworth were great company during what was some really exciting snooker. Well, thank you. We enjoyed it. Stephen was excellent. Really took to it well. And, we had a good time there. It was very exciting. So there's a couple of quick questions for you, if I may. It seems a shame the Eurosport Studio team are not in situ for the early round of the Home Nations tournaments. Will this be a permanent arrangement, do you think? I realise these things are motivated by money and you may not know yourself, but I thought I would ask just in case you did. The Studio team do add a sense of occasion to the broadcast, so it would be great to see them there throughout the tournaments. Well, I think one of the issues at the Home Nations actually is just there's so many matches to get through, so much snooker to show that, you know, sometimes maybe that full studio sort of presence isn't always necessary. They're there from the Friday onwards now. But Alan McManus is still there doing very good analysis on the touchscreen and interviewing all the winners as well. So it's still, you still get that. And I think in Scotland, from what I hear, there may be someone else involved as well who everyone will know. So, I think, you know, these things evolve, but the full studio hasn't actually been got rid of. It's just, it'll be there later in the week now. Number two, a further chill podcast with John Skilbeck talking about his book Goody Two Shoes. I believe it was due for publication a while ago. I can't seem to track it down. Do you know if it's been held up at all? I'm as far as I'm aware, it hasn't come out yet. Maybe I should have asked John before answering this question, but I will see if I can find out. But keep watching the skies. Last I heard, he was sort of just, the sort of final edits were being done. So hopefully very soon that will be out. And number three, how's your own book coming along? Well, news on that next year, so we'll leave off for now. But, done a few more interviews for it. And believe me, you'll hear all about it in due course. Dermot writes, a quick question with the prize money for the double maximum in Triple Crown events. Will Snooker Tour specified a maximum as either 147 or 155? Is it to be taken any break between 147 and 155 does not qualify as a maximum? That is exactly right. It has to be the maximum available. So a 148 with a free ball, the maximum available actually would be 155. So there's two maximums in snooker, the 147 and 155. The 147, though, has to be 15 reds, 15 blacks and the colours. It can't be with a 16 red break that is not the maximum that's available. So maximum is 147 or 155. That has always been the case, but it takes some explaining, because one day we'll probably have a 147 that isn't a maximum, and then, you know, the sky will fall in, won't it? Joe in Hungary, long-time listener, first-time emailer, thanks for the great podcast and all you do for snooker. Well, thank you, Joe. My question is, do the female players have the same WSD contract as the male players? If so, how are they able to play in the UK Championship qualifier and the Eden Women's Masters concurrently? I'm not for 1 minute comparing the Masters to the Macau exhibition, but my confusion comes from the fact that one's a WST event, the UK Championship, and one isn't. So how's it different? This email is being sent on Saturday, day one of the qualifiers, so this may even be a moot point, as Mink and company may not even enter the Women's Masters. I saw them on the live score fixtures and it piqued my interest. I vaguely remember WST releasing a statement regarding Ronnie and a Shanghai exhibition at the same time as the Northern Ireland Open qualifiers. Any information you can give would be great. I guess it is slightly different because there is an established women's circuit that is affiliated to the World Snooker Tour because it's a feeder tour for it. So they'll sign the same contract, yes, but they're playing, the women's circuit is a tour that gets you on to the World Snooker Tour. It's not seen as being in competition to it. It's seen as being complementary to it. These are all sort of nuanced things. I noticed that on the Macau, there's now two Macau Masters basically being played the same week. Both essentially meaningless affairs, really. I mean, no one's going to remember anything about them, really. They're just paydays for the players. Good luck to the players. It's a nice Christmas trip to a lovely part of the world. They'll get handsomely put up and paid and all the rest of it. But, you know, they'll be called sort of tournaments, but they're just exhibitions. And thankfully, common sense did prevail in terms of moving it to a time when there wasn't another event on. Mark Allen did quite an interesting interview with the BBC, actually, that was shown this afternoon as I record this. He sat down with World Snooker Tour this week and he said for 4 hours and had his solicitor there and spoke to I think it was the board of the World Snooker Tour or members of them, representatives of them. and a lot of the issues were gone through, and he said he, you know, there were some things he wished there was movement on, but there are other things that he took on board and maybe hadn't thought of. And that's exactly what needs to happen. Players, he took the time to go and they took the time to speak to him, he took the time to speak to them. That's how these things get resolved, by people actually talking to each other in rooms, not sniping at each other on Twitter, or X, as we have to call it now, because that's what it's called. And that seems to be eminently sensible, that's how these things are resolved. It doesn't mean the players will always come out of it happy, and maybe Will Snooker won't always come out of it happy, but fair play to Mark. He took the time to go and speak to them. He raised the issues he wanted to raise. They made the points they wanted to raise. And that's how you get some sort of, you know, coming together, I suppose, and some sort of compromise. It doesn't necessarily change the basic facts of the matter, but that is a more productive way of doing things, for sure. Hiten writes, "Hope you're well, love the podcast." Thank you, Hiten. He says, "I've been watching the Champion of Champions and noticed on a few occasions you were commentating with Stephen Hendry. I wanted to ask, what's it like commentating alongside Hendry? Does he bring any added pressure due to his status, or is he just another colleague to work with?" Well, thank you. Well, it's an interesting one. I mean, obviously, Stephen Hendry, I mean, he's just been voted number one on that list we heard earlier. But he's, you know, a legend of the sport. He's someone who I have total respect for as a player. His achievements were pretty incredible, and some of them unparalleled. You know, the dominance he had. He won the Masters 5 years running. He won the UK Championship 3 years running. He won the World Championship 5 years running, and all the rest of it. Incredible. But he's a very generous person to work with. He doesn't sort of put himself above anyone else on the team at all, you know. And let's be honest, he is. I mean, he's Stephen Hendry, but he doesn't act that way. He mucks in, he does his share, and in commentary, very easy to work with and a pleasure, actually. I mean, a great high point for me last year was at the British Open in Milton Keynes. Mark Selby made that maximum, which included the treble on the red, which I commentated on with Stephen. That was special because, you know, he sat next to someone who's made so many famous 147s himself and was so engaged in watching Mark Selby do it. So it's not extra pressure. No, I would say it's something to look forward to, isn't it? You know, because you're there with somebody who absolutely understands what's happening and can explain what it feels like to be someone who's done all that himself. And, you know, it's interesting now, Stephen's sort of trajectory is almost, you could argue possibly the leading broadcaster in the game now, because not only does he do his commentary and punditry, he does his Q-Tips channel, and he does the Will Snooker Tour podcast, and just recently actually interviewed Steve Dawson, which I thought would be interesting to mention, because I did say on here a few weeks ago Will Snooker Tour should record their own interview with Steve Dawson, and sure enough, that's what happened. And it was Stephen who did it, and Steve Dawson is the chairman of Will Snooker Tour, by the way. And there's been criticism, Sean Murphy and others have said, we don't hear enough of him. He's supposed to be the sort of front man for the sport, we don't hear him. So there was an attempt to rectify that. Stephen did a good job, actually, because he did ask him direct questions. It wasn't all sort of softball stuff by any means. And, you know, he attempted to get some answers. And I thought the most interesting part, actually, Stephen asked him, what are your sort of aims for the next few years? And Steve Dawson identified four areas that they're going to be looking at, you know, as priorities. So number one, prize money of 20 million. Number two, a broader range of international events, i.e. more different territories, not just sort of concentrated in particular territories. Number three, better engagement with fans. And number four, creating venues with better atmospheres. So these are very distinct and clear aims, and they're just on each of them in turn. I mean, they're all, you know, obviously admirable aims. I guess there wasn't much sort of meat on the bones about how it's going to happen. I mean, how does prize money go up to 20 million? I suppose it's a question of managing the business, but obviously attracting new revenue streams will help bring up the prize. But at the moment, it's something like 14 million. So, you know, there's still a little way to go, but that's, you know, a fine ambition to have. And I'm sure players will be delighted to hear that that is an ambition of WST. Number two, broader range of international events, more territories. Yeah, I mean, again, it's where exactly that strategy leads in terms of how do you get a tournament on in Let's just pick a country out the blue. Italy, okay? Well, you need contacts in Italy. You need promoters. You need sponsors. It's not as easy as just pointing at a map and saying, we'll go there. I've said this many times before. Tournaments cost a lot of money to put on. But if there are, you know, interested broadcasters, it's a good idea to try and spread the gospel as far as possible. And some of the criticism has been that, okay, we're strong in Britain, we're strong in China, we're strong in Germany. What about everywhere else? And that's fine for people to think that. I'll come back to number three in a moment. Number four, creating venues with better atmospheres. I think that is very important. I noticed at the Tour Championship now they're going to have corporate hospitality, which is good. They're making a proper effort to build that Tour Championship up as being a major event. It's at Manchester Central, you know, good venue. And that'll be a good pre-World Championship tournament, I think. Top 12 in the world this season. And, of course, it's before it's the 2 days of the mixed doubles as well, which is something different. I think we need to try. I mean, the UK Championship is fantastic. The set is probably the best set I've ever seen. It's modern, dynamic. The venue's been really decked up nicely. Backstage is good. The Q Zone, they've got hospitality. So they've done a great job with the UK Championship. The challenge is then to go to events that are less established. I've said this before, but it bears repeating, because it's basically what Steve Dawson was saying. Go to events that are less established, put them in better venues with more going on at those, in those venues, so they're better value for money for people, and the events themselves become more prestigious and more established as well. So we're not moving venues and we're not moving around. We actually find somewhere that's good. We throw a lot of love and money at it. We build it up and we try and make it into something that is special. And that's what everybody wants. The engagement with fans, I think that is in some ways the most important one, actually, because, you know, we get a lot of emails to this podcast, and a lot of them are very complimentary about visiting tournaments, but a lot of them actually do list things that they want improved, and it'd be nice to think that people could listen. Now, one way they did listen, we had an email to the podcast a few weeks ago from Lars from Canada, who was coming over, 30-hour visit. Now, hopefully I'm actually going to be meeting him myself later, so we'll let you know how that goes in the next podcast. But Lars travelled over on his own to watch the snooker for the first time. He was hoping to see Mark Selby win the tournament, which is not going to happen now. But World Snooker Tour, he got tickets for every day, I think, from Wednesday, apart from Saturday. And I was chatting with them, and I said, look, you know, any chance you maybe come all this way, if there is a ticket. And they absolutely sorted him out, which was brilliant. And they did an interview with him on Instagram, and they, you know, made a fuss of him, and actually Rachel Casey interviewed him on Eurosport. So what a great, you know, thing to do. That's only one person, but the point is, snooker fans have all got, you know, their own sort of reasons for coming and their own stories, and it'd be nice to hear more of them and actually, as I've said before, push them further to the sort of front line of the sport rather than, there's been a feeling for a while that they're kind of at arm's length, and I think if you can shorten that journey and bring them more to the fore, that's great. So I'd like to hear more from fans during events, and you're telling them, because hopefully it's true, that they're part of the event. They're not just here to watch it. They're actually part of the event. And certainly the atmosphere, obviously, that's been so great in York this week, that is created by the fans. So, yeah, so they were Steve Dawson's four sort of, priorities. And we'll obviously monitor how they go. It's clear he's not that comfortable doing interviews, but that's because he's been, you know, in the background of Matchroom for 40 years, Barry Hearn has always been the mouthpiece there, and a very effective and talented one, an engaging one, an enthusiastic one. If you ever speak to, and I do, people at Matchroom, people at World Snooker Tour, they all think the world of Steve Dawson. They say he's very, very good at what he does. Obviously, stepping into that spotlight role, spokesman role, is not easy for everybody. So, but put it this way, there's been a lot of people in the past who've talked a good game who have not actually followed it up. I'd rather have someone who actually is effective, who maybe needs to possibly learn a little bit more about how to do media interviews. The more he does, the more assured he'll be. But anyway, it was an interesting watch, and it's on the World Snooker Tour YouTube channel, and Stephen Henge, as I say, did a good job with that. Anyway, that's it. So it's a first and probably last ever Saturday edition. Thanks for all the emails. If I've not read yours out, it's probably just because I mislaid them. nothing more than that. But anyway, we'll be back at some point. The shootout, of course, is coming up next week, and then it's the Scottish Open. In the meantime, enjoy the UK Championship final. It promises to be a great occasion. And do keep the emails coming in, snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. That's snookerscenepodcast@mail.com. But for now, from York, as we always say, goodbye-bye. Sports Social Podcast Network.